This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. This week's primary in New Jersey, next week's in Virginia, Sotomayor sees senators, and the final chapter, well, maybe the penultimate chapter in the Minnesota Senate race. It's Wednesday, and time to count our ballot for the Political Junkie.
There you go again.
When I hear your new ideas, I'm reminded of that ad. Where's the beef?
Extremism in the defense of liberty is no vice.
You don't have Nixon to kick around anymore.
Lipstick.
But I'm the decider.
On Wednesdays, NPR political editor Ken Rudin joins us for a weekly political fix. This week, the Al Franken Norm Coleman Senate battle finally reaches the Minnesota Supreme Court. We'll hear from a court watcher about the long march and how Governor Tim Pawlenty's ambitions may play into this drama. New Jersey Governor John Corzine gets the Republican he didn't want, and we're coming up on the Virginia gubernatorial primary, too. Plus, Newt climbs down as Sonia Sotomayor ascends Capitol Hill. We'll talk with SCOTUS watcher Tom Goldstein about how her meetings are going. As always, we begin with a trivia question. Political junkie Ken Rudin joins us here in Studio 3A. Hey, Ken.
Neil, how are you?
I'm good, thanks.
I just want to mention before we go to the trivia question that you notice that, we hear in the beginning of the show, we hear Walter Mondale asking Gary Hart, where's the beef?
Mm-hmm.
I just want to point out to people who may not know this that last Friday, President Obama visited a local hamburger place in Washington, D.C.,
Five Guys.
And that came 3 days after he named somebody to the Supreme Court, nominated somebody who reminds people of Justice Frankfurter.
Oh.
And I thought people should remember this.
With relish, I assume.
Okay, the trivia question is, the political news of the week yesterday, Tim Pawlenty, the governor of Minnesota, announced he would not run for a third term. A lot of people think that's a prelude for running for president in 2012. Now, he thinks it'll be easier to run as an ex-governor rather than as a sitting governor. Bill Clinton and George W. Bush did win the presidency as sitting governors, but who were the last, when they were elected president, before Bush and Clinton, who was the last sitting governor elected president?
The last sitting governor elected president before George W. Bush and William Jefferson Clinton. If you think you know the answer, call us 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. The first to answer the question, of course, wins a fabulous, beautifully designed no prize. It's just one of the greatest T-shirts ever. But Ken, let's go to the actual votes we had yesterday. And this was no rivals in the Democratic side, but on the Republican side, interesting race.
Well, we're talking about New Jersey, and this is to find a Republican nominee to oppose John Corzine, the embattled Democratic incumbent. Now, there was a Democratic primary in Corzine. It was minor opposition, and he won it easily. Chris Christie, who is a former U.S. attorney, he sent about 130 politicians to prison for an anti-corruption reputation he has. He defeated a very conservative former mayor of New Jersey, Steve Lonergan, and it was about 55%. And the last Republicans to win in New Jersey statewide was Christy Todd Whitman. So apparently, your name has to be Christy if you're going to win. If you're a Republican, you're going to win New Jersey.
Interesting. During the race, Democrat John Corzine, as you mentioned, had minimal opposition in the Democratic primary, but he did take out an ad in the Republican primary. This was an attack he wanted to put against the Republican he least wanted to face, Chris Christie. Let's take a listen to John Corzine's ad opposing Republican in the Republican primary, Chris Christie.
Congressional investigators want answers from Chris Christie. The SEC accused Christie's brother of improper trading on Wall Street, but U.S. Attorney David Kelly refused to prosecute Christie's brother, although he was among the worst offenders. Chris Christie later awarded that same David Kelly a lucrative no-bid contract. Selective prosecutions, contracts for political allies. Tell Chris Christie to cooperate with investigators and tell Congress to end pay-to-play justice.
Boy, I love that music.
Well, it is somewhat unusual that a Democratic governor would get involved in a Republican primary. But we have seen it before. Gray Davis in California, when he was very unpopular in 2002, what he did was he ran ads against Richard Reardon, who was thought to be the front runner in the Republican primary, and Reardon got beaten, and that was fine for Gray Davis. So it's interesting that Corzine is doing that. He did not want to face Chris Christie. Of course, Corzine has tons of money. He was a big biggie at Goldman Sachs before he was elected to the Senate in 2000.
Back when they made money, yeah.
Exactly. But as the state's economy has tumbled, so has Corzine's popularity ratings, his approval ratings. He is in for a tough fight.
All right. We have some people who think they know the answer to our trivia question, and that is the last sitting governor to be elected president of the United States prior to George W. Bush and Bill Clinton. 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org if you'd like to weigh in. And let's go to Bob in Cleveland.
Hello?
Hi, Bob. You're on the air.
Oh, great. Thanks very much.
Go ahead, please.
My answer was Ronald Reagan.
Well, Ronald Reagan was not the sitting governor. He was standing. Actually, he was a former governor when he was elected in 1980. Reagan was governor from 67 to 74. And, of course, he was elected president in 1980. So he was a former governor when he was elected president, not a sitting governor.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
And thanks for the call. Let's see if we can go next to this is Mary. Mary with us from Leavenworth in Kansas.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
Yes. Is it Theodore Roosevelt?
Theodore Roosevelt from the state of New York.
No, well, Theodore Roosevelt was governor of New York, but after that he became vice president. Then he became president when President McKinley was assassinated in 1901. So before he was president, he was vice president, not governor.
Okay.
Thanks, Mary. Mm-hmm. Let's see if we can go next. This is Kenny. Kenny from Kansas City.
Yes, Jimmy Carter.
Jimmy Carter of Georgia.
Jimmy Carter was Jimmy Who when he was elected president in 76, but he was a former governor. His term ended in 74, and he was elected president in 76, another former governor.
Now former president. But Kennedy, Kenny, thanks very much for the call. And let's see if we now go to Chris, and Chris calling from Cincinnati.
Hello.
Hi, Chris. You're on the air.
FDR.
Franklin Delano Roosevelt.
Is the correct answer.
Ding, 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 ding.
He was governor of New York when he was elected president in 1932, defeating Herbert Hoover.
And so, Chris, for that, you will get the fabulous Political Junkie No Prize T-shirt. So we're going to put you on hold and take down your information and mail you one. And we hope that if you can master the technology or have friends who can or probably children who can, you'll send us an electronic picture so you can post it on our website.
Oh, will do.
All right. So if I can push the right button, I think I did for a change.
Few people know that FDR was named after that highway in New York.
It's true.
Yes, yeah, the FDR Drive.
FDR
yes,
Drive,
yes,
indeed. Yes. Now, let's get back to some political news. And opening now in the House of Representatives, as Representative John McHugh, a Republican from the state of New York, gets appointed Secretary of the Army.
Well, this is also a fascinating choice because if you're a conspiracy theory, and some Republicans believe in conspiracy theories, it's that Barack Obama is trying to take the best Republicans out of Congress. There are only three members of the Republican Party who represent New York in the House out of 29. It's the lowest ever. And of course, this opens up a congressional seat. And we saw what happened when Kirsten Gillibrand's seat was opened up with a solid Republican district. And yet, the Democrat Scott Murphy won that. So Republicans are very nervous that with McHugh gone, and he's been there since 1992, he's very popular. In the history of that district, it has never elected a Democrat to Congress. So, of course, if the Democrats have a shot at it, this would be with McHugh gone. Now, of course, liberal Democrats are saying, well, wait a second, are there no good Democrats you could appoint to these jobs? You know, you pick Judd Gregg and you pick John Huntsman and you pick, you know, Ray LaHood and now another Republican.
McHugh represents the North Country of New York State around the Watertown, New York area. Fort
Never
Drum.
Elected a Democrat in history.
And, well, Obama carried that district.
That's right.
Interesting. In Georgia, it appears that ex-Governor Roy Barnes wants his job back.
Yeah, there's a lot of former governors thinking about comebacks. Of course, in Sonny Perdue, the Republican, is term limited in Georgia to be one of the comebacks, hopeful comebacks for the Democratic Party. They think they'll pick up some seats in the governorships, and they think that Georgia is one of the places they'll do it.
We'll talk about a Democratic congressman this time, Pete Visklosky of Indiana, in trouble and had to step down from his committee chairmanship.
Well, he is a
subcommittee,
subcommittee chairmanship of the Appropriations Committee, and he has done favors for a lobbying group. A former lobbying group, it's since closed its doors, PMA, and some of its clients have he's gotten help for the clients of PMA, and PMA has given Visklosky a lot of money. Visklosky is a very close ally of John Murtha, who's the chairman of the Appropriations Committee.
Also might be in trouble.
Exactly, but right now there's a subpoena going on, and Visklosky thought he'd step aside because that's where his chief of staff just resigned as well. So there is a brewing scandal going on with some of these members of Congress.
We've seen a budget disaster in the state of California, and more cuts as after the voters in the referendum just a couple of weeks ago voted down a series of budget revenue raising measures. And at this point, how is that going to play into the battle over the governorship there? As it seems like every politician in the state is running.
Well, certainly on the Democratic side, you do have the mayor of Los Angeles likely to run, Villaraigosa. You think
former Governor Jerry Brown.
Jerry Brown, who's now the Attorney General. You have Gavin Newsom, the mayor of San Francisco. And then you have on the Republican side, you have a bunch of people, including Meg Whitman, the former eBay executive. And of course, because the voters turned down these measures, I mean, Schwarzenegger, the outgoing and term-limited governor, has no choice but to cut services, and drastically. One of the reasons I suspect that Tim Pawlenty is stepping down as governor of Minnesota, of course, one, he doesn't want to lose when he runs for a third term.
He said he would have won, but it's a risk.
It's a risk because he barely won the first two times, but also he's having tough fights with the state legislature there as well, the Democratic state legislature, who wants more taxes, and Pawlenty, who's a conservative, is against more taxes, and so he had to cut services as well. It's not a good time to be governors, and perhaps John Corzine will learn that in November.
And we'll find out more about that as the race gets closer, but one sad note as well, and that is that Robert Byrd of West Virginia, the dean of the United States Senate, the man who served longest in the United States Senate, hospitalized this week.
Right. He has a staph infection. He's 91 years old. He was first elected to the Senate in 1958. He is the longest serving, as you say, senator in history. He was supposed to be. We thought he'd be released from the hospital earlier. He has not been, and obviously it's something to watch.
And in Florida, another entrant, not an unexpected one, Representative Corinne Brown, entering the Senate race, formed an exploratory committee this week.
I did not know that.
Really?
No. Because Kendrick Meek is also running for the Senate.
Indeed.
And he's also African-American member of Congress. I did not know about Corinne Brown.
I get a junkie T-shirt.
That's why I love listening to the show, because you learn so much there.
Well, indeed. Well, stump Ken Rudin. All right. Ken, stay with us. We'll find out what else you don't know about Minnesota when we get back. We're going to be talking about what happened in the courtroom this past Monday as the election between Al Franken and Norm Coleman finally went to the Alan Page, the head of the Purple People Eaters.
I didn't know
is
that either.
Be ruling on that. Yeah, anyway, stay with us. 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. How's this all playing out in the state of Minnesota? Give us a call. I'm Neil Conan. Ken Rudin, our political junkie, is with us every Wednesday. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Political junkie Ken Rudin is here, as he is every Wednesday. He's NPR's political editor. When he's not, when we're not stumping him with trivia questions, you can he's blogging at his website. You can find that at npr.org/junkie. As we said, arguments in the Minnesota Senate race have gone to that state's Supreme Court. If you have questions about how this is playing out in Minnesota, give us a call. 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. And Elizabeth Stawicki has been watching the case. She's the legal correspondent for Minnesota Public Radio, and it's good of you to be with us today.
Well, it's good to be here.
And how did the arguments go on Monday?
Well, actually, it was as lively as a bench as I have seen these justices, and I've covered them for about 13 years. And, you know, so right now we're waiting for the court to come back. And I should just kind of frame the issues a little bit. Coleman had appealed a three-judge panel ruling that found Franken won the election by 312 votes. And he went to the state Supreme Court to order the panel, to ask the panel to go back and count more absentee ballots. His lawyer said that the panel that heard his election contest used too strict of a standard in deciding which absentee ballots to count. And these, again, had been ballots that had been previously rejected for a variety of reasons. The panel ended up counting about 350, and his lawyers say that if the panel had used the right standard, the ballot pool would have been closer to about 4,000, giving Coleman more chances to overcome Franken's lead.
At least a statistical chance to cut into or overtake the lead.
Well, at least some hope there. And Franken's side said, listen, the panel is simply following the law. It's that the legislature that set that strict standard for what qualifies as a legal absentee ballot in Minnesota.
And to some degree, at least how this played out in the national press, Elizabeth, was that this was a replay of Bush v. Gore.
Well, I'm, you know, it's hard to say. I know that I don't really think that it was. And I'll, and for the reason is that this had got brought up in Coleman's side. And earlier on, I should tell you that in a previous state Supreme Court hearing, one of Coleman's lawyers had brought up the whole idea from the get-go that this is a Bush v. Gore case. This is a Bush v. Gore case. And that, you know, we were repeating Florida. And one of the justices who's also sitting on this same Supreme Court said, cut him off at the knees and said, you know what? This isn't Florida. This is Minnesota. Argue the case on Minnesota law. And so I think, you know, I think that has been brought up. But there's also the question of, you know, that the U.S. Supreme Court's ruling in Bush v. Gore was pretty limited, and that, you know, they haven't really gone back to that. So it's, you know, it, I guess in a sense it depends on which side you talk to, but I think the sense is here anyway from the state Supreme Court that maybe Bush v. Gore isn't really playing as big here as it might be in the national realm.
And the other impression that we got is that there's no reason to believe that the state Supreme Court is going to do anything but uphold the lower court decision and declare Al Franken the winner.
Well, you know, if you talk to them, they would say no. I mean, they would say that, you know, they look at every case anew, and particularly kind of the legal jargon in this is that they're reviewing this de novo, which means that their standard is that they're not supposed to give any deference to what the three-judge panel did. They're supposed to look at this brand new, and they're the ones who are supposed to be deciding the law. Now, having said that, the arguments were pretty testy, if I can say that. They seemed to be more pointed towards Coleman's lawyers, but they also were, you know, pretty pointed towards Franken's as well. But I think, you know, there's one thing that kind of struck me during those arguments, and that was there were a couple of justices who had said flat out to Coleman's lawyer, listen, you're making an argument, but you're not providing the evidence to back it up.
Ken?
Elizabeth, what I thought was most telling, or at least the headline that came out of Pulenti's announcement, Governor Pulenti's announcement yesterday that he would not run for a third term, is that he said if the state Supreme Court or asked him or suggested that he certify the Senate election, assuming it's Al Franken, he said he would do so. And I think that's a question that a lot of people were asking. What would Pulenti do in this case?
Well, it was an issue mostly because I think earlier on he had kind of hedged. You know, weeks ago when they were asking, well, you know, would you sign the certificate? He was kind of saying, well, I don't know that necessarily I have to, which he says people overblew this. But the sense, though, was, okay, if the state Supreme Court found in favor of Franken, would then Pulenti say if Coleman decided to appeal, let's say, to the U.S. Supreme Court or file another case in federal court?
Which Michael Steele wants him to do, the National Republican chairman wants him to do.
Exactly. Whether or not that was still part of the state appeal process under the law that required the governor to have to sign it. Now, yesterday when he announced that he wasn't going to seek a third term, you know, he said he will sign it. And also, too, I should mention that Franken's attorneys specifically in their briefs before the Minnesota Supreme Court had put in there asking the Minnesota Supreme Court to directly order the governor to sign the certificate.
And the other part
so
of the
there wouldn't be any question.
The other part of the speculation, of course, was that Tim Pawlenty, thought to be running for the Republican nomination for president in 2012, might have been angling towards the Republican base by saying he's not going to authorize the 60th Democratic senator to take up a filibuster-proof majority on Capitol Hill. Anyway, let's get some callers on the line, and let's begin with Mark. And Mark's with us from Minneapolis.
Oh, good afternoon.
Afternoon.
As a Minnesotan who's been involved in recounts as long as, must be 17 years ago, actually, the process is really very transparent. And one of the things that has bothered me most of all in this has been the shifting positions of the Coleman attorneys on what their grounds are, as well as their continuing to confuse and confound basic concepts in terms of Minnesota election law. They keep on talking about intent and how somehow voter intent should be considered in absentee ballots. Well, under Minnesota law, all physical ballots are scrutinized for voter intent, but the bar to cast a ballot, whether it's in person or absentee, is statutory, and it's very clear. And if you don't meet the criteria, you can't cast an absentee ballot. And if you don't meet the criteria, you cannot cast a ballot in person.
And Elizabeth, is that the kind of argument that you heard in court on Monday?
Well, this kind of goes to, you know, the heart of one of the major arguments. And that is that the Coleman side would say, listen, we want to enfranchise voters. Minnesota wants to enfranchise voters. And as a result, we think as long as people, quote, substantially comply, that is that they mostly get everything right in filling out these ballots, in having witnesses and that sort of thing, that they should count. Now, the three-judge panel said, no, that's not quite what it is. It's a legal, strict standard. You have to have these particular requirements, and if you don't have them, we're not going to count them. Hmm. The problem is that the statewide canvassing board back last year, when it was doing a statewide recount, included some ballots that, under this three-judge panel's definition of what is a legal ballot, wouldn't have been counted. And so that's another kind of, you know, nuance to this case. But it is gets back to, okay, what standard are you using as what qualifies as a legal absentee ballot?
Okay, let's see if we get another caller on the line, and let's go to Chuck. Chuck with us from Atlanta, Georgia.
Hi, good afternoon. I actually am a former Minnesota voter who voted for Governor Pawlenty, and you know, I want to remind people of a couple things. One is the number of dollars that the GOP pumped into the Minnesota campaigns when it came to looking at Minnesota as a swing state for the presidential race, and it turns out that the margin was just too large to include it, you know, the next time into the fold as being like an Ohio or a Missouri, another state like that. And the other thing that I want to look back on, you know, some decades ago, we don't want to see Minnesota and the District of Columbia in a Mondale type of Reagan race, whereby if we pick Governor Pawlenty for a GOP ticket, he may barely get that state, perhaps some of the surrounding states, but he's...
Oh, the D.C., Minnesota, that's Mondale, that's where his, the two places he carried, yes, of course.
Yeah, it just might end up seeing the reverse of that.
Ken?
Well, that's some thought, but Minnesota actually has gone the longest of any state without voting for a Republican for president. The last time they voted GOP was Nixon in 72. So the thought is if Pawlenty has some value on the national ticket, it would be in the upper Midwest where the Republican Party has been weak lately.
Chuck, thanks very much. Interesting point. Let's see if we can go next to this is Greg. Greg with us from Columbia, South Carolina.
Good afternoon. I understand that in addition to Norm Coleman and Al Franken, there were other candidates in the race, and I believe the Green Party and the Independent Party both had candidates in the race. What difference did that make, and is the state legislature considering instant runoff voting to avoid this sort of thing happening again?
Well, on the difference, Ken?
Well, certainly. I mean, Dean Berkeley, who was the independent candidate who briefly served as senator after Paul Wellstone died, he was appointed by Jesse Ventura. Dean Berkeley got 12% of the vote in the you know, so obviously that an independent vote was very important. But Elizabeth, I guess the question is whether there's any discussion about state runoff, and I think there's not. Is that correct?
You would have to ask me that. I think there is a case right now at the Minnesota Supreme Court that has to do with instant runoff voting in Minneapolis, but I don't think we've had a ruling on that yet.
Okay. Elizabeth Sawicki, thank you very much for the call. Appreciate it.
You're very welcome.
All right. Elizabeth Sawicki is the legal correspondent for Minnesota Public Radio, and let's see if we can get to some other issues. And well, wait a minute. There's another one. Anyway, we're talking with Ken Rudin. Ken Rudin's our political junkie with us every Wednesday. You can read his political junkie column. And Ken?
Remember earlier when I was shocked that you told me Corinne Brown was going to run for the Senate in Florida? Here's a quote in today's Miami Herald from the Broward Democratic Party chairman. If you had asked me a week ago if Corinne Brown would run for the Senate, I would have been totally shocked. So, see?
Well, you're not the only one that's surprised then.
I rest my case.
Anyway, the Associated Press was not so surprised. We're talking with Ken Rudin as we do every Wednesday. 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. I'm Neil Conant. Stay with us. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's see if we can get another caller on the line. This is Cynthia. Cynthia with us from Vernon, New York.
Hi, guys. And I want to tell the story to Ken because I'm a 79-year-old upstate New Yorker. And they asked me 20 years ago, I got a call saying, will you be an election inspector? I said, I don't think so. They said, we're desperate for a Democrat. So I thought it over, and then I did it for 20 years and gave the money to a soup kitchen that I earned, you know, doing that. But I just want to have a comment about this John McHugh. I don't think, you know, I want to speak for people, a lot of them that I knew, that I know, voted for President Obama for change. And now that he's appointed this Republican, a man who's never voted against a Pentagon defense bill, I don't quite understand what's going on. I think we have one party now, not the Republican or Democrat, but the war party. I'd like to have Ken's ideas about this.
Ken?
Well, actually, I mean, you're probably 20 years ago or 30 years ago, you probably were the only Democrat in upstate New York because that was solidly Republican area. And now you can only, it's so hard to find a Republican up there. But it's interesting that you're making
a point.
Huh?
He's kidding.
There's a lot of Republicans.
What did you say?
I said, you said there's hard to find a Republican.
Oh, I'm sorry, hard to find a Democrat.
Go ahead.
But I think a lot of people, I've seen this on blogs as well, that people said that if this is supposed to be the change we voted for, why do you have you're not going to have an anti-war Democrat as a Secretary of the Army. And I think John McHugh does have a very good record and good, a lot of Democrats really respect what he has to say, but he really cares about the servicemen and support of veterans. Rights and things like that, but there are some people say that this has become a militarized appointment that should have gone to more of a more moderate person. But it did surprise a lot of people.
Yeah, because we're all for the servicemen, you know, all of us, no matter what party we belong to.
All right,
I think that the point is that a lot of people are upset at you know, Obama, and it was hard time to get a Democrat, voted in here in my district after 25 years of a Republican being there. So,
all right,
the big picture is how is this going to affect voters? Are we able to judge?
Cynthia, with all respect, didn't Barack Obama run as somebody said he would reach across party lines and be a bipartisan president of the United States?
He voted, he said, Neil, with all due respect, he said, I will end the war. I will bring the troops home. And now there are 3 million refugees in Pakistan that are people who are refugees now since Obama and Hillary Clinton came in and have a fourth front to this war in Pakistan.
A stretch to call Pakistan part of the American war effort in Southeast Asia. But anyway, Cynthia, I think we take your point. I wanted to get to one more thing with Ken. Yesterday, a ceremony at the White House where former First Lady Nancy Reagan was there to be there as President Obama signed a declaration to appoint a commission to find out ways to celebrate her husband's 100th birthday. Today, she was on Capitol Hill where a bronze statue was unveiled honoring Ronald Reagan in on Capitol Hill. And, well, in the ceremony yesterday at the White House, Barack Obama said something about Ronald Reagan bringing back optimism optimism that was badly needed.
It was this optimism that the American people sorely needed during a difficult period, a period of economic and global challenges that tested us in unprecedented ways.
At a period other people might describe as the Carter administration.
Well, that's some people wrote to my blog the same thing. They said, wait a second, was he dissing Jimmy Carter? I mean, by praising Ronald Reagan and that he restored a sense of optimism, is it because of his predecessor? Which reminds me, when George Bush said we're going to have a kinder and gentler country, does that mean he was dissing Ronald Reagan?
President Obama's nominee to the Supreme Court is back on Capitol Hill today, hoping to ease concerns from some Republicans about comments she made about ethnicity and gender. We'll talk about the politics of the Supreme Court nomination when we come back, if you'd like to join us on that. 800-989-8255, email talk@npr.org. Stay with us. Ken Rudin will. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Political Junkie on Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Right now it's Wednesday. Political junkie Kent Rudin is with us, and it's visiting week for Judge Sonia Sotomayor. She's meeting privately with Republican and Democratic senators who will vote on her nomination. Some of them raised questions about personal bias and judicial activism, among other concerns. Yesterday, she met with the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, Patrick Leahy, the Democrat of Vermont, who addressed the issue of life experience.
What she said was, of course, one's life experience shapes who you are. But ultimately and completely, and she used those words, ultimately and completely, as a judge, you follow the law.
That after Judge Sonia Sotomayor was quoted as saying that a wise Latina woman would make better decisions on some cases than other people would. And that led some Republicans and Republican spokesmen to describe her as racist. The ranking Republican on the Senate Judiciary Committee, Jeff Sessions, says that's not a word he was entirely comfortable with.
I will not use that kind of language. I think there's on some of the questions that come up, like affirmative action or those sort of questions, people who feel strongly about it use strong language. I think the right thing to do is ask what the law is and how she decided those cases and not use pejorative terms.
And Senator Sessions said he enjoyed very much meeting with Judge Sonia Sotomayor yesterday. Well, what issues do you think the Senate Judiciary Committee should consider before they vote? Give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. You can weigh in on our website, npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. And we've asked Tom Goldstein, the founder of SCOTUS Blog and an attorney here in the Washington, D.C. firm of Akin Gump, to assess how her meetings on the Hill are going, at least thus far. And he joins us from his office. Tom, nice to have you on the program today.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thanks so much.
And most of the heat seems to be coming from that that one remark.
Well, it really does. Race is an explosive issue in the country, particularly when it comes to ideological divisions between the left and the right. It's also a question that's in front of the Supreme Court in one of her cases. But kind of inevitably, if this were a Republican president nominating someone, then Democrats and liberal organizations predictably would find something to be very upset about. And this is the thing that the right has found to be upset about with Sonia Sotomayor.
And it's interesting that among those using the R word, the racist, was former Speaker of the House Newt Gingrich, who climbed back today.
Oh, yeah. He wanted to really try and respond to critics who thought that the debate was going to be counterproductive for the Republican Party, particularly electorally, given the importance of Hispanic voters, and also probably realize that when you do things on Twitter or you send an email, sometimes you say something that's kind of silly. And he wanted to have maybe a more productive debate about it. As Senator Sessions said, look, let's talk about the merits of the decision, not impugn the character of the person who's making it.
There are other cases that are being raised by special interest groups, and that includes Judge Sotomayor's ruling in the so-called nunchucks case, which bears upon the Second Amendment, which, of course, has the NRA and its allies watching very carefully.
Oh, sure. But she got some great cover on that question yesterday. So the question here is, look, the Supreme Court pretty recently in a case out of D.C. actually said that the Second Amendment's right to bear arms actually protects an individual right. You have in certain circumstances a right to have a gun in your house, for example. And Judge Sotomayor was part of a panel of appellate judges who was confronted with the question, okay, well, D.C. belongs to the federal government. What if it's a state law or a local regulation. And she said, well, that's up to the Supreme Court. Previously, more than 100 years ago, the Supreme Court said states and localities don't have to follow the Second Amendment. If the Supreme Court wants to overrule that decision, it can do that, and you can take an appeal up to the Supreme Court. And there was huge criticism on Judge Sotomayor's nomination about that decision, but now two very prominent Republican judges out of the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals in Chicago have ruled the exact same way. And so it's much harder to paint Judge Sotomayor as a liberal ideologue on that question.
Here's an email we have from Adam in Salt Lake City. There is a lot of hullabaloo about the race comment, but as a conservative, I'm more worried about her comment that appeals courts are where policy is made. I thought policy was made in the United States Congress and in the White House. Why have Republicans let that go and focused instead on a misguided race fight?
Well, I don't think they've really let it go. It's certainly a critically important issue. Judge Sotomayor at a panel at Duke University's law school talking to graduating students about the difference between a trial court and a court of appeals distinguished them on the ground that in a court of appeals, that's where policy is made. If she meant by that judges interject their own views about policy, that would be really troubling. That's not the job of judges. They're forbidden to do that. But I think what's clear from the context is that she meant, look, Court of Appeals judges have to fill in holes in the statutes that there are ambiguities. Congress says you can't discriminate. Well, what exactly does that mean? And so courts of appeals, as they're trying to resolve uncertainties in the statutes or the Constitution, actually ultimately are making policy. But you have to distinguish there the impermissible effort for a judge to interject her own views. And I don't think that's what she was endorsing.
Ken?
Tom, in addition to the speeches she may have given and the comments she may have given, obviously I suspect that the real fight will be over her ruling and the situation with the New Haven white firefighters.
Yeah, that's going to be the case that's front and center. Just as a touch of background here, New Haven had a promotion test for firefighters. White firefighters did much better than minority firefighters, and New Haven threw out the results. When the white firefighters and one Hispanic sued, Judge Sotomayor was part of an appellate panel that affirmed a trial court ruling throwing out the lawsuit. The Supreme Court then took the case up, and it presents a really knotty question about discrimination law, because the white firefighters have a serious argument. They were supposed to get promoted, but on the basis of race, they were denied those promotions. On the other hand, the city is really worried that black firefighters will sue it for having an unintentionally discriminatory test that favors whites. I think the Supreme Court is likely to say either 5-4 or by a broader margin that the Court of Appeals and the trial judge didn't give enough weight to the claim of discrimination by the white firefighters. And the thing I would say about that, however, is that while Judge Sotomayor's panel, which was one of three judges, is likely to be reversed, it's very unlikely that it's going to be in terms that make her decision look crazy or stupid or ideological. It's just a hard, hard case.
Let's see if we get a caller on the line. And this is Steve. Steve calling from St. Louis.
Hi. I'm very interested in Judge Sotomayor's views about very large statutory damages. This has come up to the court before with regards to punitive damages, and the Supreme Court has said that in some cases a ratio of, let's say, 3 or 2 or even, 1 to 1 in terms of punitive damages, but there's a lot of concern in some areas of law like copyright law that somebody could do something, violate the law, and then face an enormous fine that may violate the Constitution.
And is this, just to clarify, Steve, punitive damages are you're fined a certain amount and then extra is added on because for a penalty. Is that what you're talking about?
Punitive damages are you do something and as a result of the maliciousness or, just you've done something that society wants to sanction, whereas frequently, let's say you get on a bus without a ticket, you may face a really large penalty in order to deter future conduct, but there are questions, particularly with scholars, about what the outside limits of that are. It would be absurd to say you could fine $10,000 for going on a bus without a ticket.
Tom Goldstein, is this going to come up?
Oh, it'll come up. It'll probably come up at the hearings from senators who are concerned about business issues. And if she's confirmed, as she almost certainly will be, she'll confront that on the Supreme Court, this question of the constitutionality of large punitive damage awards, whether or not those awards violate the principle of due process. But we don't really know the answer on this question, like a lot of questions, say the death penalty or gay rights or abortion or the separation of church and state. Even though Judge Sotomayor has been a Court of Appeals judge for 11 years, she hasn't had the opportunity to be on a panel opinion that really talked about those questions. So the honest answer is, here, as in a lot of important areas, her views are a bit of a mystery.
Thanks very much for the call, Steve. And those important areas include areas like, well, gay marriage and abortion.
Oh, goodness knows. You can't imagine in a country that's so concerned about the Supreme Court's influence on critical social issues, questions that'll be more in the forefront of the public's mind, of the senator's mind. But there's not really any sort of record from Judge Sotomayor about whether or not what she thinks on those questions. And at the same time, there really isn't a power for the Senate and the senators and the Judiciary Committee to force her to answer those questions, because she quite logically and by tradition will say, well, I'm not going to tell you how I would rule in a particular case because that can and will come in front of me. Instead, they have to ask more abstract questions, sort of, what do you think of the right to privacy in the Constitution, which underlies things like the right to an abortion and claims to a right to gay marriage? And they have to infer an awful lot. She's probably going to take the bench at the Supreme Court with just as much mystery about her views on those questions then as there are today.
In passing there, you said she's probably going to take the bench. Amid all of this kerfuffle about these comments, everybody thinks she's still going to be, barring the discovery of the love child, confirmed?
Yeah, because this is the world of politics as much as anything else. We're talking about a Senate that by the time the vote occurs will have 60 Democratic votes. We're talking about a Latina nominee to the Supreme Court that has tremendous objective qualifications. The idea that there would be 51 votes against her or even 40 votes to filibuster her just doesn't compute politically.
We're talking with Tom Goldstein, the founder of SCOTUS Blog, an attorney at the Washington, D.C. firm of Akin Gump, along with political junkie Ken Rudin. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get Tim on the line. Tim calling from Des Moines.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Go ahead, please.
I oftentimes get frustrated that so much of this debate centers around the issue of abortion or affirmative action. There's a few other issues that I'd like to hear more about, which are, for instance, signing statements, the War Powers Act, election reform, the problem of money being equated with speech, and eminent domain. And those are issues that I haven't heard much about in the debate that's going on currently.
All very live issues, Tom Goldstein.
Oh, goodness knows. Now, she has talked some about property rights. She did have a case involving the governmental taking of properties that has got property rights advocates very concerned. But things like presidential powers, a lot of other hot-button social issues and political issues that couldn't be more timely given the debates about Guantanamo Bay, for example, rendition and the like, she hasn't yet issued opinions on, cast votes on, and so we don't really know what she would have to say. We also can't infer, I would say, just from the breadth of her decisions, is she on the left? You bet. But is she a hard left ideologue so that you could say, well, she's going to vote however somebody who is incredibly liberal would vote? Definitely not. You can look at her opinions in the criminal law for example, which many times favor the government, cases involving companies rejecting discrimination claims. She's much more of a judge who tackles cases based on the individual facts rather than on broad ideological principles.
Thanks very much for the call, Tim. And Ken Rudin, I wanted to ask you, one of the leitmotifs, if you will, of this hearing, which will get underway possibly in July, is that the new ranking Republican on the Senate Judiciary Committee, Jeff Sessions of Alabama, well, he's got an interesting background in terms of the confirmation of federal judges.
Exactly. In 1986, President Reagan nominated him to a federal appeals court, which would be a lifetime appointment. And because of past statements that were perhaps changed around or misinterpreted or interpreted the way the Democrats wanted interpreted, they were seen as racist or at least racially insensitive, and he was defeated. His own home state senator, Hal Heflin, a Democrat, voted against him too. So it's very interesting in the fact that also Republicans had Arlen Specter as their ranking Republican. The difference between Arlen Specter and Jeff Sessions is enormous, but Jeff Sessions has been very, very careful. He's aware of what he went through in 1986, and unlike some conservatives like Tom Tancredo, Newt Gingrich, he says, look, this is not the way to go after her. You don't go after her on personal terms. You examine her record. And I think Sessions' approach has been very interesting to watch.
And Tom Goldstein, as you, this will be our first chance to see Jeff Sessions in such a high-profile position.
It will be. And so far, I think he's done an impressive job. He has really tried to shy away from extreme rhetoric. He's really positioned himself well to be able to make arguments about when the hearing should be held. Because right now, the debate, let's be honest, is unless some ethical transgression is found, she's going to be confirmed. So the debates are, when are the hearings going to be held and what will the margin be? And how will the different parties look in the minds of the public at the end of the process? And I would say when he's been dealt a very difficult hand, when the margin of the Senate Judiciary Committee is 12 Democrats and only 7 Republicans, when the margin in the Senate full Senate is going to be 60-40 or so, so far I think you have to say that he's been impressive.
Ken?
And one quick thing to add to Tom's point about 60-40, there's also 7 Republicans who voted for Sotomayor in 1998 for the U.S. Court of Appeals, including Snow and Collins of Maine and others. So it may be a much larger margin than just 60.
And getting back to your point on timing, Tom, if you're the Republican Party, you want to drag this out as long as possible because that gives you more time to find something might come to surface.
Yeah, that's the thinking, although I don't know that I agree with it, but that's certainly how they're positioning this. They make a fair point that she's got 3,000 opinions, or cases at least, that she's decided she's only written about 230 majority opinions on the Court of Appeals, but that they want the opportunity to study them. But I could, you know, I defer to y'all's political expertise, but it seems to me that whether you want this thing to go out over a longer period of time depends on whether you're looking good or bad. And if the country starts to get frustrated and think that the Republicans and conservatives are just launching unfounded attacks at Sonia Sotomayor, you might want to bring that to a close, particularly if you don't have any realistic hope of something bad turning up or the country turning against her. But as things stand now, the debate is that the Democrats, who actually hold the levers of power in the Senate, want hearings probably in the week of the 13th of July, the 20th at the latest, so that they can get not just a committee vote but a floor vote by the time the Senate leaves for its recess on August 7th, whereas Republicans would rather miss that date of the 7th and have the Senate go away for around a month at that point in August so that she can't be voted on until September, and who knows what happens in the meantime.
And the same Jeff Sessions who said that we should investigate and look at all of Sotomayor's rulings when Samuel Alito was nominated to the Supreme Court, he said, let's speed this up. We don't have time to look up through everything.
Okay, well.
All right, everybody switches sides.
Ken Rudin, thanks very much, as always, for being with us. Ken Rudin, our political junkie, NPR's political editor, with us here in 3A, as he is every Wednesday. And Tom Goldstein, thank you for your time today.
No, thanks so much for having me.
Tom Goldstein is the founder of SCOTUS Blog and attorney at the D.C. law firm of Akin Gumpen, with us from his office here in Washington, D.C. Tomorrow, President Obama addresses the Muslim world from Cairo and hopes to redefine relations between the United States and Islam. Will he succeed? We'll talk about it tomorrow. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. I want to grow up to be a politician. Land, and take over this beautiful land.